Good evening. Another Navy ship struck by coronavirus. Mass testing for the virus kicks off in New York. Will the poorest be covered? And 50 years since students were killed for protesting in Ohio and Mississippi. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with some of the news for Friday, April 24th, 2020. The United States Navy confirmed Friday that a second warship is suffering an outbreak of COVID-19. The guided missile destroyer USS Kidd reported 18 sailors have tested positive for the virus. Navy spokesperson Jonathan Hoffman made the announcement at a news conference.
Confirmed that there has been a sailor on the USS Kidd who had symptoms, medevaced off of the ship to a hospital in San Antonio, medical treatment facility in San Antonio, where he was tested and was unfortunately found to be positive with COVID. As a result, the Navy has, using lessons learned from other cases, they have flowed a medical evaluation team, a specialized medical evaluation team, onto the Kidd. I think it's an eight-person team that is conducting testing on the ship. There have been other positive cases. I don't have the number, but I think the Navy will be able to give that information later. They are preparing to return to port, where they will undertake efforts to clean the ship. They will remove a portion of the crew from the ship and work to get everybody back to health and get the ship back to sea. But that medical crew on the ship right now has been conducting contact tracing, has been working to isolate individuals they believe may have been exposed and take measures to protect the crew.
The ship is returning to its home port in Everett, Washington, where the crew of 300 will be quarantined. There was a COVID-19 outbreak on the carrier USS Theodore Roosevelt last month. The commanding officer, Brett Crozier, was relieved of command for distributing an email asking for help. The Theodore Roosevelt has been sidelined in Guam with almost 20% of its more than 4,000 crew members testing positive for the virus. Meanwhile, the New York Times reports during a meeting on Friday with Defense Secretary Mark Esper, Navy leaders recommended Crozier be reinstated to his command. But in an unexpected holdup, a news conference to announce the reinstatement this afternoon was reportedly canceled. Crozier was relieved by a Trump appointee who later resigned. As Crozier left the ship, video showed hundreds of sailors chanting, "Captain Crozier, Captain Crozier," as he departed the aircraft carrier. Crozier, who contacted COVID-19 himself, has since recovered and is awaiting in quarantine. And in election news, former Vice President Joe Biden, the presumptive nominee for the Democratic Party nomination, says he's worried Donald Trump will try to delay the November election. Biden said, "Mark my words, I think he's going to try and kick back the election somehow, come up with some rationale why it can't be held." He made the remarks during an online fundraiser. Under the law, no president has the power to postpone a presidential election. To change the date, Congress has to intervene. And officials are being forced to rethink how Americans will vote this November in the teeth of the coronavirus pandemic. Voting by mail has emerged as a tactic endorsed by many Democrats, but the idea has been denounced by Trump with unfounded accusations of corruption. Today, Trump opened a new front in the attack on the mails, threatening to block coronavirus funds from the United States Postal Service for not charging enough to deliver packages.
Raise the price of the service they give, which is a tremendous service, and they do a great job, and the postal workers are fantastic. But this thing's losing billions of dollars, it has for years, because they don't want to insult, for whatever reason you can imagine, they don't want to insult Amazon and these other groups. If they don't raise the price, I'm not signing anything. So they'll raise the price so that they become maybe even profitable, but so they lose much less money. Okay? And if they don't do it, I'm not signing anything, and I'm not authorizing you to do anything, Steve.
A few hours later, Trump backtracked, saying he would never let our post office fail. Meanwhile, Congress is beginning talks on another recovery package called the CARES Act 2 for an economy reeling under the coronavirus pandemic that added another 4 million plus to the unemployment rolls last week. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said today that the next recovery bill must help localities that have borne the brunt of the pandemic.
There will not be a bill without state and local. Okay. But the Fed should be doing that anyway. And I'm in communication with Chairman Powell about what we enabled the Fed to do in the last bill, I wanted the word shall do this. They used the word shall, but they used shall endeavor to, which isn't quite the same as shall. But nonetheless, the chairman told me he took that as a shall so that they could relax. When we were originally having this conversation, he said, I have to understand the creditworthiness of, oh, we're going to get paid back and this or that. And so, you know what? We're in an emergency. We have to see ourselves through this. So the Fed has to play a big role in all of this, and they are playing a much stepped up role than they were a month and a half ago. We'll see how it's working as we do this bill and see if they need any more legislative justification.
Meanwhile, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo uses his daily briefing to remind New Yorkers how easily the virus can spread. Cuomo also agreed with the president that the World Health Organization dropped the ball. He said by the time the world was aware of the danger of the disease, it was already spreading from Europe, not China. Cuomo also said it's too early to think about reopening, showing a graph indicating a second wave could be much worse than the first.
If you say, well, we're done, can't stay in the house anymore, let's just reopen, just start business tomorrow. Let's go. What happens? That's what happens. All the progress we made is gone, and all experts, or virtually all experts, will say not only does the virus spread increase, but it increases to a higher point than we had increased the first time. Again, this is a remarkably effective virus at spreading and growing. So I know everyone's impatient. Let's just reopen. That's what happens if we just reopen.
Despite the warnings, salons, barbershops, and other businesses reopened across Georgia on Friday after Governor Brian Kemp defied opposition from the president, public health experts, and some mayors in his state. But for the New York City Housing Authority, the focus today was on testing for the coronavirus. At a hospital in Lower Manhattan, public advocate Jumaane Williams, wearing a face mask, held a Zoom press conference to report on how testing, especially for NYCHA residents, has been going.
I'm in front of Gouverneur Health Center. It's across the street from LaGuardia, houses from NYCHA, which is Smith over here. And there's some more as well. It's a cluster. Earlier, I was in Brooklyn with Councilman Alika Heber-Samuels, who's the chair of the NYCHA committee. We were at Cumberland Health Center across the street from Fort Greenhouses. We've seen a lot of people showing up, which is great. And Cumberland is a little low. They just opened for the first time today. They saw over 40 people when I was there. They're expecting a big rush tomorrow. When it's warmer. Here they've seen over 100 people already. They've been open already for 3 days. The first day they saw about 40 people. They won't be open tomorrow. Some of the sites won't be open on the weekends. Most of the folks here found out about it from the news, whereas when I checked sites last week, most of them have found out about it by calling places like 301 or seeing the number advertised. I would say one of the main differences between the state and the city tests that I've seen so far, as many of the state sites are by appointment only, but we need to have more options. And so the city sites, which are good, they're all walking. They're taking everybody. When I was in the Bronx, one of the issues is they only had a capacity of 200 or so. They saw over 200 people today. And when I was there, they had 150 people by 8:30 in the morning. So we may have some cases as it warms up. We may have a lot of people coming to this. And so we have to deal with the capacity. But I also just want to say, while I'm glad these things are happening, it's April 24th, and it seems like the folks are just finding NYCHA on the map. Well, that's a big problem. And so there's so much more that NYCHA needs. We've been speaking with tenant leaders. I spoke about what some of those are. But all of our leaders here locally were very, very slow to act. I just want to remind folks that that wasn't Donald Trump. That was the mayor, and particularly the governor, who asked for and received unprecedented amounts of power. In addition, we got a lot of stories in parts of the city that his dropping off of PPEs yesterday was a debacle because they had no real infrastructure in place. And again, they're not speaking to the people who are on the ground, and there should be more people involved in the decision-making process. My office has asked for a task force to be put in place immediately to deal with such issues. Hopefully on the city level, they'll get a response. I would also invite everybody to go to advocate.nyc.gov, advocate.nyc.gov. We put out a recovery and response, response and recovery report a few weeks ago, and we updated a weekly.
One of the subjects on William's mind was the fear that people might take advice President Trump made last night that ingesting disinfectant or use of UV lights might work against the virus.
So supposing we hit the body with a tremendous, whether it's ultraviolet or just very powerful light, and I think you said that hasn't been checked, but you're going to test it. And then I said, supposing you brought the light inside the body, which you can do either through the skin or in some other way. And I think you said you're going to test that too. Sounds interesting.
We'll get the right folks who could.
Right. And then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute. 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning? Because you see it gets on the lungs and it does a tremendous number in the lungs. So it'd be interesting to check that. So that you're going to have to use medical doctors with. But it sounds interesting to me.
Williams said Trump's suggestion was one of the most irresponsible things he's ever heard.
I never thought we'd have to tell people, do not inject yourself with bleach. Do not put bleach or other cleaning products on your skin. But unfortunately, we do. Sadly, we have a president who literally has no idea what he's doing. Very often, people are confusing being rich with being intelligent. My hope is that the people who are intelligent and have better conscience around him will just continue to ignore him. To that end, my hope is that local leaders would do better, and which makes me more agitated when I see a mayor and a governor who had certain powers that they could have used better and didn't use them better. I haven't heard of anyone, thankfully, yet using bleach. We do know, and I heard of stories before when he was pushing the miracle cure of people losing their lives or doing some crazy things trying to get that product. I don't know what to say. I just wish Republicans, and it's clearly them now, who will continue to lift him up, will stop. It's just remarkable. If this was a movie, we would have walked out already. No one would have wanted to see this, a stupid movie like this that made no sense. But that's where we're in. So I'm sad about it. We're going to continue to push out information from my office so people say, so we can clarify what people should and shouldn't be doing.
Public advocate Jumaane Williams. Meanwhile, in Albany, an enraged Governor Cuomo continues his skewering of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Yesterday, the leader suggested a new law be passed allowing states to declare bankruptcy. Cuomo says, I dare you.
Legally, a state can't declare bankruptcy. You would need a federal law allowing states to declare bankruptcy. So to the Senate that proposed it, I say, pass a law allowing states to declare bankruptcy. I dare you. And let the president sign that bill that says, I give the states the legal ability to declare bankruptcy. It's your suggestion, Senator McConnell, pass the law. I dare you. And then go to the president and say, sign this bill allowing states to declare bankruptcy. You want to send a signal to the markets that this nation is in real trouble? You want to send a international message that the economy is in turmoil? Do that. Allow states to declare bankruptcy legally because you passed the bill. It'll be the first time in our nation's history that happened. I dare you to do that. And then we'll see how many states actually take you up on it. I know I wouldn't. But if you believe what you said, and you have the courage of conviction, because you're a man of your word, pass that bill if you weren't just playing politics.
In New York City, Mayor Bill de Blasio on Friday called on the state to extend the New York's existing eviction moratorium to 60 days past the end of the coronavirus crisis. He also called for a rent freeze.
The bottom line is tenants need more help. And the first thing we have to do is make sure that comes from the city of New York. I'll talk about what the state needs to do, and there's a lot the state needs to do, and they need to do it quickly. But the city has to do our part of the equation, and that comes to our rent guidelines board. The challenges that landlords are facing right now are real. I'm not belittling them, but they pale in comparison to the challenges that tenants are facing. It is abundantly clear, of course, the Rent Guidelines Board will hold hearings. It'll go through its process very quickly and get to a decision. But to me, it's abundantly clear we need a rent freeze.
And 2 million New Yorkers live in apartments whose rents are regulated by the Rent Guidelines Board, whose members are appointed by the mayor. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. May 4th, 2020 marks the anniversary of the killing of four students and wounding of nine others during an anti-war protest in 1970. At a time when thousands of campuses were upended by protests against the war, when 18-year-olds had to fight but had no right to vote, students poured out to demonstrate all over the United States and in Kent State, Ohio, after the Nixon administration launched an invasion of Cambodia, further widening the war that had killed millions of Vietnamese and nearly 60,000 American troops. At about noon on that day, Ohio National Guard troops, ordered out by the governor under pressure from Nixon, opened fire on the unarmed students. Two of the dead were protesters. Allison Krauss, Jeffrey Miller, and the other two, Sandra Scheuer and William Schroeder, were heading to class. Allison's sister is Laurel Krauss. She's a longtime advocate for an accounting for the deaths.
Allison was very vocal and was a protester. She was in the front rank. She's a tall girl, like me. I'm her younger sister. I was 15 when she's 5'8", a stunning beauty, very smart student person. She was in the honors program at Kent State University, always had a book in her hand. She was protesting the Vietnam War and her friends having to go fight in it with the draft and everything related to it. The day before her killing on May 3rd, 1970, there was a beautiful day on campus and the National Guard were posted all over campus with their tanks and their people carriers. It was a war scene on campus. So they were also protesting the occupation of their campus by the military. Why were they there? She got into a conversation with one of the guardsmen who had a flower, a lilac, in his gun. And his superior came up to him and yanked the flower out, gave the young soldier a hard time about having a flower in his rifle that someone else had put there. And my sister came forward and yanked the flower out of the superior's hand and said, "What's the matter with peace? Flowers are better than bullets." And "flowers are better than bullets" is on Allison's gravestone. She stood for peace on May 4, 1970, and she got gunned down for it.
What was the government's role at Kent State in 1970?
The FBI was involved, and the FBI is COINTELPRO. The secret army of COINTELPRO is the FBI. But what most people don't understand is COINTELPRO brought in groups and special agents related to their expertise for special projects. Kent State and Jackson State were special projects. The proof that we have is there was an agent provocateur. His name was Terry Norman. He's been totally erased from the Kent State story. You're not allowed to mention his name on the campus with people who have created the 50th anniversary. He was working for the FBI, taking pictures. He was there. He provoked an event that with his pistol, creating four shots before the commands to fire. He, in my opinion, he created the sound of sniper fire so that the guardsmen, the Ohio National Guardsmen, had a reason to turn, shoot, and fire at unarmed students more than a football field away at Kent State University. The real telling part of this was when, just after May 4th, 2019, when we had a very nice 49th, we had a speaker for Allison, Carlos Jones. He's a performer, reggae performer, and he wrote a song. This amazing performance he did for Allison at the commemoration of the 49th. But right after that, we learned that President of Kent State University, Beverly Warren, had appointed Stephanie Dane Smith to be the chair for the 50th anniversary coming up. It was just so odd that they would put the CIA in charge of the Kent State 50th. What does the CIA have to do with the Kent State massacre is what we asked. And so we started digging into Stephanie Dane Smith, and we find out that she went to school at Kent State University from 1975 through 79. She was recruited to work at the CIA during her tenure there. She went on to Harvard, where she got her master's degree in public communications, government communications area. The CIA paid for her schooling, as they do for many recruits. Part of her work was actually writing the CIA torture report.
Why did they pick her and not somebody who was there?
The CIA has to be in charge of the Kent State Massacre because they're so culpable in what they did. They were one of the chief creators of what happened that day.
Where were you that day, and how did it affect you and your family?
I was getting off the bus on May 4, 1970, and a neighbor ran up telling me that Allison had been hurt. It took a long time for me to get my parents home. They both worked. My mom came home. She learned. We tried reaching by phone, but all the phone lines had been cut. All the electricity and all the water had been turned off at Kent State University within minutes after the massacre. We went to the hospital to identify Allison's body that night. And at the hospital, we heard from the armed military that were present at the hospital that were harassing us. They should have shot more, that the students deserved it. So we were wondering, what did Allison do to deserve this? We couldn't imagine what she had done. And what she had done is she had protested the war. That's what Allison did to get killed. We've been censored and blocked for 50 years. So Sandy, Bill, Jeff and Allison were four students that didn't deserve what they got. There were two protesters in the mix, Jeff and Allison. They've had all of their rights taken away in every way. We need to remember these people. We need to have it examined correctly by sources other than the FBI or our U.S. government.
And that's Laurel Krauss. She's the sister of Allison Krauss, who was killed at Kent State. On May 15th, National Guard troops opened fire on dormitories at Jackson State in Mississippi. Two students were killed, Philip Lafayette Gibbs and James Earl Green, and 12 were wounded. And seven Catholics affiliated with Plowshares, a nuclear abolition movement formed in the 1980s, will be sentenced for damaging a nuclear submarine base in Kings Bay, Georgia next month. The Plowshares activists, who take their name from the biblical edict to turn swords into plowshares, had entered a major U.S. military installation which holds Trident nuclear submarines and scores of missiles in 2018. They call themselves the Kings Bay Plowshares 7. Carmen Trotta is one of the activists.
We went on to the base, cut through fences, went under the cover of night, and went to different places on the base, poured our blood, raised signs calling for peace, remarking that nuclear weapons were illegal and immoral, spray-painted certain areas with biblical graffiti, quotes from the Bible, or quotes like love one another. And for that, we were basically, if we were to have had our way in court, we would have went with an international law argument, because nuclear weapons, according to international law, are clearly illegal. The judge at trial referred to that, our notion that the nuclear weapons were illegal. She said that was a dubious proposition. And the United States has, in my entire lifetime, the United States has been withdrawing from all forms of international law. So none of this was available to us. We also did try and do a very unusual, brand new trial project, which was to invoke the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. That ultimately didn't do us much good. It really wasn't something that we were able to use at trial.
What is that act? So, what's the background?
If the court understands that you had and were acting upon that this was a religious practice and that you were sincere in your religious beliefs, that the government needed to use the least restrictive means of hampering you. Government had to show its own compelling interest, and it had to weigh them, but it was supposed to use the least restrictive means. What the court accepted was that conviction on three felonies and a misdemeanor was the least restrictive means. This was a very biased opinion of the judge, in part because I think she understood that no one messes with the military-industrial complex. So this is a very, very bright, powerful woman, our judge. She knew to go with the flow. Over the years, an international law argument has been harder and harder to present before a court. We assured the world that only five nations would keep the nuclear weapon and we would negotiate them down to zero. And we have done no such thing. We have now withdrawn from the INF Treaty. We've withdrawn from the New START Treaty. We've withdrawn from the Iran deal. And we have kicked off a massive nuclear arms race once again. So we are back to the Cold War. At this point, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, who at the time of our action said that we were 2 minutes to midnight, which is the lowest the United States had ever been, the nearest they thought ever to another nuclear exchange. More recently, we are now 100 seconds away from midnight, away from that massive nuclear exchange. You can look at our surrounding of Russia over the last number of decades. I could run through that with you, but it's an enormous number of nations that have been added to NATO, which would include the Czech Republic, Hungary, Poland, Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, Slovakia, Slovenia, Albania, Croatia, Montenegro just recently under the Trump administration, Macedonia just recently, and we have Georgia and the Ukraine right in the wings. So we have kicked off a very, very dangerous political environment. In fact, the day after our trial, Mikhail Gorbachev, the person who had offered the United States total nuclear disarmament in 1987, and the Reagan administration didn't accept it. The day after our trial, he wasn't commenting on our trial, but he said that the great problem today, the greatest problem before us, is the militarization of politics and the pulling away from international law.
Carmen Trotta is one of the Kings Bay Seven who's facing sentencing for anti-nuclear protest in which they damaged a base in Kings Bay, Georgia, used to house nuclear Trident submarines. And that's some of the news for Friday, April 24th, 2020. The news is produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.